All right, good evening. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Need to press on into chapter 2. Sundays are hard because we don't get so many of them for Sunday classes. So, but let's go back to chapter 1, look at a little bit more there, get into chapter 2, and see if we can get through that towards chapter 3 tonight. And while you're finding chapter 1, let's get someone to volunteer with us in a word of prayer. Thanks, Paul.
Let's pray. Our dear Father in heaven, we thank you for this good day that we can worship you together. We thank you for your Son who gave his life for us. Please help us to follow this pattern. In Jesus' name.
Amen. All right. So chapter 1, you know, Paul's big point, verse 18, remember, the basic issue is you guys don't get along, or there's disunity. Part of why there's disunity is because there's conflicting mindsets, conflicting priorities. And even when you share in common the value system of the world, the value system of the world inherently leads to conflict because the value system of the world promotes self. The value system of the world promotes strength and power. The value system of the world promotes intelligence or rhetoric and persuasive ability, entertainment values, things like that. And even if everybody shares those values, like in our culture, in one sense, everybody shares those values, but those values inevitably lead to conflict, ironically. And so Paul comes along and says, the problem is you guys are still thinking like the world. You intellectually have bought in to Jesus as the Son of God. You've been baptized because of your sins. You get that much, but you have not bought into the mindset. So we'll get to chapter 2 now. He says a little bit more about that. But because you still think like the world, he builds up this contrast in chapter 1 to kind of, you know, contrast the wisdom of God versus the wisdom of the world. Because you haven't made that transition at a deeper level yet, you know, you still got problems there in your congregation in terms of right now how you get along, and then in terms of later on how you even evaluate sin and what's going on in the church and individuals' lives. You've got the wrong operating system. And that is one of the metaphors I like to use when we begin to talk about this kind of stuff. Most of us kind of live, if we're not careful, it's easy to live on kind of app-based spirituality, you know, kind of limited program, a limited operation, as opposed to operating system where from the ground up, you know, stuff that's supposed to work on iOS doesn't work on Android. And stuff that's supposed to work on Android doesn't work on iOS. And, you know, my coworker hits me up all the time with, I really need to get an iPhone so he can text me properly. Because my Android operating system and his iOS don't mesh well, right? You know, understand what texting is like. And of course, Google now is desperately trying to catch up with these new updates they're pushing to you got yours? Yep. They're desperately trying to make messaging in Android work a little bit more like iOS does. And so, because anybody who's got an Android phone knows exactly when your friends are, you know, texting you back from iOS because they like or laugh at, you know, Anna's not, she knows too.
Is that green or blue?
Yeah, exactly. You know, is it green or blue or gray? So depending on, but we can still customize more on Android. That's all I'm saying. Anyways, so what happens though spiritually is we kind of function on the app level. The app level is, I understand Jesus, Son of God, I'm baptized for forgiveness of my sins. I can dot some I's, cross some T's doctrinally. But if you don't understand what your operating system is doing, you'll get the blue screen of death. You don't update your operating system. Yeah, I mean, I knew somebody recently. They were like, I just got a brand new computer. Why am I getting the blue screen of death? They took it to an IT person. IT person like, oh yeah, well, a bunch of updates. That's what happens. If you don't get your operating system, get your operating system cleaned up, you're going to have your entire, your apps aren't going to work anymore. Does that make sense? Have you even been prompted to update your operating system on your phone because like your banking app won't work anymore because your current version of your operating system is not secure enough? Or is that just me? All the young people are nodding and everybody over a certain age, and I won't name that age.
we did it for them.
Oh, Eric, don't go there. Don't go there. That's right. If you don't know what I'm saying, ask your grandchildren. No. No, but at least for a younger generation, that analogy works well, operating system versus apps. Everybody else, I apologize, we'll move on now. So what part of Paul's trying to say, though, is it's a mindset level, not just a knowledge level, okay? And in chapter one, we'll just say a little bit about this and look at one or two other things we didn't look at from chapter one, verses 18 through the end there last week, and then we got to get into chapter two. In chapter one, at the 30,000-foot level, Paul holds out the cross as kind of a symbol for the whole system, for the whole transition from the world's value system to God's value system, a wisdom, a mindset, a way of thinking and evaluating reality, of evaluating right and wrong, of prioritizing what's good versus what's better, what's best, if that makes sense. What's worldly versus what's spiritual, even when things may not be technically sinful, how do you discern what's leading you closer to the world versus what's leading you closer to God and Christ and the age to come? Are you living more a life that will work in heaven, or are you living more a life that may be technically, doctrinally, barely, literally, legally Christian, but not real, but still kind of keeping a foot in the world? Does that make sense? And so the cross of Christ is Paul's great symbol for the great transition. Part of why we don't quite get the power of what Paul's saying here is because we live, even though a lot of people now call what our times a post-Christian society, there's still enough vestiges of it, and most of us have lived long enough, even those of you who are still relatively young, you've still lived long enough with Christianity and a slightly Christian culture, that we don't realize how much Christianity has impacted our culture's values. You know, people call it human rights, but why did for the first time in human history people decide, you know, slavery was wrong, or we should treat, you know, women with dignity and respect, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Why did we even come up with these human rights and these human values? Influence of Christianity. There's a reason it happened in the West and not the East. There's a reason why it happened here. And so the irony is, even kind of, you know, liberal human values are all, you know, even though we want to move past Christianity, it's not possible without Christianity. Because Christianity was the first religion to really push. Plus, because it was there in Judaism, a lot of Jewish interpretation didn't always catch it. But certainly Christianity had an influence way beyond Judaism because of its ethics of specificity. To really mainstream the image of God in everybody. Islam didn't do that. Eastern religions don't do that in the same way. Christianity did that, put it mainstream. So we don't quite catch, you know, the full force exactly what Paul was saying in a world that was still fundamentally pagan in its mindset, in which certainly not every human being had equal dignity and wisdom. I mean, Plato famously talked about different souls being made of different metals. You know, and so a rightly organized society recognized, you know, kind of what each person's inherent worth was. If you're going to, you know, yeah, the Republic can be terrifying when you go back and read it. And so what he wants them to understand is that God came, or in the cross of Christ, God is destroying the wisdom of the wise, and discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who's wise? Where is the scribe and the debater of the age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Because, and here's the proof or here's his answer to that rhetorical question, that God has made foolish the wisdom of the world. Because in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through its wisdom. The world did not figure out God. What's the world's version of knowing God? It's called idolatry. Even if, you know, the Jews claim to know God, but was their version of God, even the law of Moses' version of God anymore? No, that's why Jesus was disgusted with the temple. Because even the Jewish understanding of God at the pop level and the elite level, for that matter, was no longer what Moses had taught in the Pentateuch. Thus, even Jesus is disgusted at what Judaism had become. The world, because outside of the cross of Christ, you will never fully get God. And that's why everybody made a mess of it. And that was part of God's point, was, you know, basically that no one would boast, as Paul's going to make clear in just a minute. It pleased God through the folly of what we preach, the foolishness of what we preach, to save those who believe. Because the Jews want signs. The Jews always want some extra proof. And by the way, that's how it worked even back in Exodus, right? God's just split the sea. What are they saying literally 3 days later? 3 days after the parting of the sea. That's all it was, if you go back and read Exodus. We're thirsty, and we're hungry. 3 days. And by the way, before they see all the plagues, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and come on. The Jews always wanted some extra proof, is God among us or not? Which, by the way, is part of why, for that kind of a mindset, there will never be enough signs, enough evidence, enough proof. The Greeks, on the other hand, want something more intellectually sophisticated, what they consider wisdom or intellectual sophistication. For the academic, it will never be academic enough. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews, foolishness to the Gentiles, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. What do you see when you look at the cross? Do you see foolishness? Do you see myth? Do you see a crucified criminal? Or do you see God blowing up all human categories? Because for starters, he defeats death by yielding to death. He blows up political power by showing if all you can do is kill, that's the ultimate political power, is execution by the state, then you have no power because I just give life back. He literally blows up the myth of political power. And on it goes. The cross subverts every way of looking at things. Even Jewish religion based on the law of Moses, because what does God say? This is the real sacrifice. This is how sins are actually forgiven. Not all the years of rabbinic interpretation and tradition that you've built up around this. This is how I really solve your problems, not from sacrifices forever with a Messiah who just basically rules like the world rules, because that's what we always do. We'll turn God's stuff into worldly values. The cross blows it all up. Everything from the best attempts at religion to the best attempts at politics, the cross blew it all up. Because the foolishness of God, from the world's perspective, is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. The weakness of God, God lets himself be killed. And in so doing, shows the absolute impotence of the human race. For consider your calling, brothers, that not many of you, in fact, were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful, not many were noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing that things that are. Harvard and Yale will never be impressed by us. It's not saying an individual Christian can't go there, but the point is the value system of the elites will never look at us and say, that's it. And God does that. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, that are nothing, to in turn bring to nothing the things that are. Why? So that no human being might boast in the presence of God. It's always grace. It's always a gift. At the end of the day, all you can do is say, man, God bailed us out. God makes even Christians have to bow the knee and say, man, I didn't see that coming. The only reason I'm saved is because God completely blew up all expectations and all pretense of power. And because, verse 3, because of him, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. And so when I came to you, brothers, I did not come to you proclaiming testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom. I wasn't going to do it by the world's ways. I wasn't worried about being eloquent or entertaining. No strobe lights, laser light shows, or awesome guitar riffs. Because that's what the world says makes for interesting religion. I'm not going to do that. I'm simply not going to play by the world's categories. I decided to do nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. Because all the rest of that panders to human emotions or human desires or human enjoyment. It takes the focus off of, you have to change how you think, what you want, what you desire from the ground up. Operating system changeover, not just app-based solution. You got to complete it. And so that's why you got to keep the focus on the cross. Not on methods, not on entertainment value, not on eloquence, none of that. Anytime any of that becomes a focus, you lose sight of the cross and a complete inversion of your sense of reality that it brings. Does that make sense? Strong stuff. Strong stuff. For I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you, therefore, in weakness, in fear, and much trembling. Paul did not hold an impressive gospel meeting. He was not somebody with charisma who naturally drew people to himself. Because if you wound up hanging around with Paul, why were you actually there then?
The cross.
The cross. And because you realized that what he was saying was actual truth. And you realize the bankruptcy of everything else around you, intellectually, politically, religiously, spiritually. You did not hang around with Paul because he was a good time, because he was eloquent, because he was impressive. In fact, he brings it up in another of his letters. I'm not a cool guy, I know that. I'm not the life of the party. I'm not powerful in the pulpit, in terms of usual standards. What makes him powerful and what draws people, therefore, is the truth of the message. And so my speech and my message were not implausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men. You wouldn't come here because, you know, the worship leader was incredible, or because the preacher gives you a bunch of life hacks for Monday morning. You come here because you found truth and therefore found ultimate reality. And that starts with recognizing the cross of Christ is the key to everything, a complete inversion of the world's way of living and the world's way of thinking and what the world desires and what the world says is wise and right and good and effective. Blows it all up. And the goal then is that your faith might rest not in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. That's how ultimately, again, you know, even to see now, think about other lines of thought that you're more familiar with in Paul's other letters, like in Galatians, you know, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. You know, Philippians chapter 2, you have to empty, you know, be like Christ in emptying yourself of yourself so that Christ can dwell in you. You know, I died when I was crucified with him, Paul says in Romans, basically, you know, that being baptized is a death to self and the world, a death to it, just like Christ died on the cross to this world, literally in the sense that not just that he bodily died, but when he comes back, you see, is when Jesus, after the resurrection, you think Jesus in any way, shape, or form was worried about anybody stoning him or crucifying him again? You think Jesus gave any thought to Rome or Caesar? Think about it. You think Jesus was at all in any way concerned about tiredness or hunger any longer? No. He died to all of it in the resurrection. And part of what the Bible is saying is, while our biological death is still something that hangs over all our heads, part of what Paul is trying to say across his writings and how we spread together is, you have to die to the world in that level as well. So that politics simply isn't a preoccupation. The only reason you're worried about politics is so you have the wisdom to know how to raise your kids, protect your kids, you know, position the congregation, if you're the elders, to be able to do what we're supposed to be doing. But other than that, you're simply not worried about politics on the same level everybody's worried about. It's only simply, let me know where the landmines are so I can as strategically navigate as I can. Jesus wasn't worried about Caesar. He just didn't want to die before the hour of his proper death had come. But not because he was worried about the politics of the situation. And he had to build back better or make America great again, depending on which way you want to swing. Does that make sense? It was always dead to him. It was always dead to him. And even more so after he comes back, because literally, he may be in this world, but truly, he was not of this world anymore. None of even the concerns of where he would lay his head or what he would eat mattered anymore. Dead to all of it. And that's what he calls the rest of us to do. And that's what the apostles did. And that's the challenge, and that's the maturity of faith that goes beyond the app level. I understand enough to obey the gospel, versus I have truly, deeply become a Christ follower at the deepest level's operating system. This is the level I live on now. All this stuff is dead to me. I see it for the foolishness it is. I see all these fighting for power politically. None of them have power. They just don't know it. None of them have power. They just don't know it. Remember what Jesus says to Pilate? Pilate says, don't you know I have the power to kill you or release you? What did Jesus say to Pilate? Anybody remember? You have no authority but what's been given to you, man. Come off your high horse. And by the way, remember what John, that's in John's gospel, remember what John says that did to Pilate? Rattled him. Because underneath it all, he knew there were nothing underneath the robes either. You know. And so there it is. All right, stop for comments or questions real quick. Yeah, sorry, Randy.
It's also kind of interesting to see how Jesus interacted with his disciples and other people after he rose from the dead.
Yeah.
Because his message was the same, but it was sort of a different tone, if you will, in that, what are you going to do? I mean, all of that threat was completely gone. Right. I mean, there was nothing that anybody could say to him, threaten him with, anything. I mean, because it was, all of their threats had already been dealt with and taken away. So at that point, Jesus was able to really articulate sort of what the kingdom was when he talked with the different, especially the disciples.
Yeah.
Because when they were coming face to face, it was like, I mean, I don't know about you, I'd be a little nervous if I, you know, woke up and met somebody that came back from the dead 3 days ago.
Well, and remember, they were scared.
And they were scared.
They were scared.
Because that's a realm we don't understand easily. But I think when we come to grips with just what happened and how he interacted with his disciples, it should give us a glimpse of what reality surely looks like.
Yeah. And that's a great way to put it. And to that end, you know, why were the apostles able to do what they did? You know, we look at that, you know, look at Paul's catalog of sufferings in 2 Corinthians, stuff like that. Why were they able to do what they did? Because they had met a man who was ultimate reality. Right. And they had seen it, they had talked with him, they had touched him. You know, Thomas got to finally get to have the opportunity to do whatever. Jesus made very clear, I'm not a ghost, remember Luke's gospel, because that's what they thought it, but they don't know. We're seeing something as a ghost. Casper's come back. No, 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 no. Jesus said, "Look, you know, bring me something to eat, and I'll eat, not because I need to eat anymore, just to show you I'm here." Ultimate reality. And because they'd seen ultimate reality, and because they'd seen the end, they'd seen the final destiny of man, both in terms of who's the leader, who's the true king, and what awaits for all of us, because his resurrection was the down payment on our resurrection. That's why they could do what they did. The question is, do we have enough faith to do exactly what John in his gospel says? Well, records the words of Jesus. They are blessed are those who have not seen yet believe to that level. And that's the challenge.
One last comment.
Oh, yeah, please.
Jesus's body after his death should not have worked.
Well, that's the point. That's right.
You know,
that's right.
Even when he talked to Thomas, here, go ahead and put your hand in my side.
Yeah.
I mean, his body was so damaged that it...
Correct.
It can't work. But that's yet, right. It could work because of the spiritual nature of Jesus.
Well, and part of what, if we had time, you know, Paul actually makes this point in 2 Timothy. The quality of life that God gave Jesus when he raised him was not just a purely biological part, it was literally a quality, you know, the way we put it, if I were to paraphrase it, it's a qualitatively different kind of life.
Right.
So that literally, when Paul says his death had no power over him anymore, literally, you know, he was so transformed, you know, but it was the same body, but there's a quality, and our minds can't get our minds around it, because there's miracles, and there's the miracle,
right?
The creation of a new kind of life for human beings that transcends what we got in Genesis.
That's right.
And that just, you know, it's been, you know, so again, those men had seen that.
Yeah.
And that's why they could do what they did. Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
The other thing that I think is interesting, too, is we talk about throwing out conventional wisdom. you go right back to the first person to see him is Mary.
Yeah.
You know, and it just keeps taking it steps further. Like, that's not who, if you were trying to build a case for this being real.
According to this world's values.
Right.
Yeah.
This world would not say you need to go see a woman first.
Yeah. Yeah,
But that's where he
right.
You know, I think that, I think that's powerful.
Yeah,
in and of itself.
Agreed, and I think that's part of too. You know, where especially the way John tells the story of the tomb. You know, it is truly a taking the hand of the woman and says that he was the seed of woman, no dad. Why does God do it this way? That ultimately truly crushed Satan's head because Satan took advantage of a woman in the garden. He's born solely seed of woman, and then in the garden it's the woman who first gets to, and John's gospel in particular really depicts it as another Eden,
great, yeah.
Just undoing, and in one sense elevating back, you know, Satan did this, you know, took advantage of you this way, I'll now, you know, put my hand out, so to speak, and it's a stunning thing to ponder, absolutely, and to your point, that's the whole thing, God is simply saying, my reality is not what you, this little mess of a sandbox you made.
His weakness is bigger than your strength.
That's right.
That's
God's worst day blows right. Your best day out of the water. If you want to be, you know, kind of, you know, literalistic. Yeah, that's right. So, Jeff.
Talk some more about the power of the cross, and like I'm thinking today, Satan's one of his best, greatest accomplishments is mainstreaming pop culture of the cross.
Yeah.
And how hard it is to really get anybody, I mean, by all intents and purposes, we're a Christian nation.
Right.
How do you lift up the hood and there's real power of the cross versus what, by and large, everybody's version of the cross?
Yeah. That's a great point. Is that, you know, again, because Satan, you know, the Bible makes clear, is still wandering, looking for whom he may devour, and, you know, is making war on the saints because he knows his time is short, to steal a phrase from Revelation. You know, what do you do if you finally now realize, you know, this is what God was up to and this is how God accomplishes his purpose? You domesticate it then. You domesticate it. You take the sting out of it. You know. And it's kind of a joke, you know, like investing. You know, you don't want to be investing in a stock right when everybody else is investing in it, because that means that most of the upside's gone, it's probably too high and about to crash or whatever. You know, was it Warren Buffett used to say, you know, be fearful when everybody's getting greedy? You know, that's, you know, when you want to watch your investments in the market. And that's the same thing. You know, when the cross no longer has the scandal, you know it's been domesticated. Because what the cross ultimately does is it doesn't make you respectable, it makes you rejectable. The cross inevitably will bring you into conflict. And that was Jesus' point in John's gospel, right, to his followers. In the world you will have trouble. but be of good cheer, I've overcome the world. But the way you overcome the world is by embracing the cross, not running from it. Because the way is not around, the way is through. That's the hard truth about Christianity. A Christian that does not lead to some sort of suffering, some sort of persecution, whether it's awkward holiday dinners with unbelieving or fallen away family members, whether it's difficulties in the workplace because you won't fudge the numbers, cook the books, affirm what you're supposed to affirm in June or whatever it is, you know it's been domesticated when you lose the risk of confrontation with the world because you're not living a scandalous life anymore, which is literally in Greek Paul's word for the cross. It's a scandal. It's a scandal. It's something that creates, you know, what's a scandal to this day? When you even use that word, you know you can Greek, but Greek's all over English. What's a scandal?
A mess.
It's a mess. It's a mess. But what makes it what makes the mess?
Greed.
Greed.
Well, greed. Yeah, but it's something that blows up the status quo. You know, the scale. You know, the married politician caught in bed with the prostitute. Oh, there goes the image. You know, the famous CEO that's now serving time up in Bryan, you know, because she swindled investors, her technology really didn't work. What was her name? Elizabeth Holmes, I think that was her name.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, big to-do. Remember, she was on Time Magazine and the next big thing, and Forbes, you know, 40 under 40 or 30 under 40 or whatever. And it turns out, you know, she cooked the books, fudged the data, and it was all a fraud.
Never had anything.
Say again?
And she, nothing ever happened the whole time.
Right? Yeah,
in money from investors.
Yeah, the ultimate, you know, everyone wants to be on the new hot thing. This is the hot new thing. Always, you know, Warren Buffett's riding a break when everybody doesn't get greedy. Because it was built as a technology that would change healthcare.
Yeah. Recent crypto scandal.
Yeah, oh yeah, you know, just, you know, whatever. You know, it turns out that Bernie Madoff, who's a name that's an infamy to us because none of us are rich enough to have been investing with him, but in New York City circles for decades, if you had money, he was the guy. You know, because you know, when you have real money, you don't invest with some of these, you know, Edward Jones or one of those guys. When you have money, you have a private, you know, some guy who knows what he's doing. You know, it's kind of like, you know, that little level they call them the Black American Express cards. You know, if you didn't know it exists, that's okay. You weren't rich enough to have one anyways. It's one of those kind of things. That's who Madoff was in New York City financial circles. And so the scandal, when it turns out, all these returns for decades, giant Ponzi scheme, and the crash of 2008, he just couldn't keep all the plates spinning under poles anymore.
Set of paper files upstairs.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember, but the big financial meltdown. You know, a lot of guys got caught, you know, doing stuff. And, you know, guys like Madoff and Andrew Stafford, with the connections that Hughes got caught. But there was, in the holidays, and I don't know why alcohol commercials have to be the funniest, but they have a budget for it. They just can't afford the better marketing guys. But it was a picture like a holiday scene on the street level. Of it's supposed to be like, you know, kind of a winter wonderland kind of idea, you know, all this little light snow falling and people and kids in the street, to those who have been good this year, you know, Merry Christmas. And then kind of the camera pans upstairs, and where all the snow really is, it's a bunch of business people frantically shredding everything in sight and throwing it out the window. And to those who are not good this year, you know, just but yeah, just one of the funniest things in that season, because everybody knew, you know, all the financial shenanigans the bill had come through for all these folks cooking the books in the financial world. So yeah, it was shredding like crazy. So yes, ma'am.
The scene after Jesus is resurrected that we were talking about versus the garden scene, he gives us women whose heart is seeking after him to even adorn his body, his physical body, with that unction of love that they had. And so he's creating this new picture, this new view of her that's different. He sends her with that message, and that's that message is just so valuable. Tell them that I'm risen. To be able to see that in your faith, touch the throne to the point that he sends an angel to confirm that is powerful testimony of faith.
Yeah, it was quite a day. Quite a day and quite an event. Well, let's push on because there's never enough time. So what Paul does, and again, he doesn't write like we're used to writing today. Thank you for that. verse 31, he drops a hint of what's going on there. I'm sorry, I'm chapter 2, verse 5. That's what I'm trying to get to. Why has God done this? Why has God done what he's done with the cross? So that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. That you'll quit learning to think like humans and value your PhDs and your MDs and your NDs and your, you know, chartered financial analyst and your, you know, American Meteorological Society approved weather reports and whatever. Get over all the credentials and standards and everything. Get over that. Ultimately, it's got to be in the power of God. That God does things you cannot. God understands things you don't. God knows things you can't know. God understands things you can't comprehend. And that's why there at the end of 1 Corinthians in verse 31, he quotes, "Let him who boasts, boast in the Lord." Go back, well, just for sake of time. He gets that line from Jeremiah chapter 9. And of course, Jeremiah chapter 9, Jeremiah is God's prophet to a dying age, right? And to a society that has finally reached its full level of sin and corruption so that God's about to destroy it. What do you say to a dying society? Well, God gave Jeremiah words to speak to a dying city. And so one of the things that God had Jeremiah say, Jeremiah 9, verse 23, "Thus says the Lord, let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, let the mighty man boast in his might, let not the rich man boast in his riches, but let him who boasts in this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who practices chesed, steadfast love, justice and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight." That's what you feel good about. That's where you build your self-esteem, your sense of place in the world, you know, what life's about. You don't boast on what the world says you've accomplished or what the world says you ought to have accomplished. You boast, you know, of course, ironically, you won't literally boast if you actually understand the Lord, but you get what Jeremiah and what God are getting at. And that's where Paul gets this line. It's a dying game to live otherwise. You become part of a dying world. And remember, he said earlier in chapter 1 that this world, verse 18, the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. This age is passing away. Don't make the same mistake that the Jews did in Jeremiah's day and buy into the thought world of a dying city, a dying country, and a dying world. Sanity is found in knowing God, nothing else. All right, so given that our faith is not supposed to be in the wisdom of men of the world, but in the power of God, Paul's now got to take a detour and unpack that phrase or that contrast. That's what the rest of chapter 2 actually is then. Okay, Paul, say a little bit more about the wisdom of God and the power of God over against the wisdom of the world. And that's what the next 10 verses are. So among the mature, we do impart wisdom, though it's not the wisdom of this age or the rulers of this age who are doomed to pass away. Again, don't buy into a dying system. Because where is Rome today? No, it's a tourist trap. That's what Rome is. That's all it is. You go and you see a bunch of fallen down buildings, some of which they had to put back up. And is it impressive? Yes, it's impressive. But let's be honest. The Colosseum is cool, but NRG's bigger. Remember when the Astrodome was cool?
Yeah.
And what are they using the Astrodome for right now?
Storage.
And the debate is whether to tear it down or not. Think about that. This age is by definition always passing away. And so among the mature we do impart wisdom. It's not though a wisdom of this age or the rulers of this age who are doomed to pass away, but we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God which God decreed before the ages of glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this. For if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. They actually understood how the world really works. They wouldn't have done what they've done. Go back and read Jesus' warning to Pilate. You don't understand how authority works, man, if you think you're the one in control right now. This was just God's plan before the foundation of the ages. You're making a choice. It's a free choice. Just God knew what your choice would be, and that's why God's plan is going to work. But dude, you're not in control. And by the way, Andrew, take notes on that.
We'll say that again.
Do what? Oh, if you missed it, never mind. Go back and watch the tape later. We can talk about that tomorrow. That's a little inside joke between a conversation he and I had this week. Anyways, go back and watch about the 35-minute mark. You'll understand. But we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God. Now, understand what Paul is saying. What Paul is saying there, and especially in the context of the rulers of his age had understood. Now, did the rulers of this age, were they guided by the best wisdom, the best knowledge, the best intelligence they had at that time? Of course they were. Rome had great engineers. Herod had great engineers. Part of why you can go to Jerusalem to this day and see the leftovers of some of the Herod's building projects. They had the best of the intelligentsia around them. That's what they did. Daniel's day. Why is Daniel and his friends serving in Nebuchadnezzar's court?
They're smart.
Because they're good.
That's what kings do. They strip mine the talent of the conquered and use them. Well, just like, I'll get you. That's what they do. And so you surround yourselves with the best and the brightest. And what God is saying here is the rulers of the age still blew it when all mattered. In fact, they've blown it many times. What did the prophet say about the Assyrians? They think they're doing this on their own. And the Babylonians, he really thinks he's doing this on his own. And Cyrus, Cyrus thinks he's doing it on his own, but he doesn't realize that he's just my servant. Isaiah chapter 45. Oh, they think they're doing it on their own. They don't. They don't know what's going on at all, even though they surround themselves by the best. This would never be understood if God didn't reveal it. That's his point. At the end of the day, you know nothing of the actual true reality and the actual useful soul-saving importance unless God told it to you. Which is why we don't get to chapter 4 and remind them, what do you have you did not receive as you get big in your britches? You have nothing of soul-saving meaning. You have no mentally stabilizing truth and sense of reality unless God has actually told you this. Because all you got short of that is a mess. All right, yes, ma'am, what you got?
One tiny caveat, and yeah. That's simply that throughout history, most rulers had too much of an ego to really follow surrounding themselves with the best. There were obvious examples of times where they did that, usually because they had to, but a lot of times the next person comes into the power, well, we want our own crew, whether they're the best or not.
Yeah. Yep, echo chamber and nepotism, always with us. That's exactly right. Well, let's keep reading. So none of the rulers of this age, because the truth of the matter is you're never going to get, you will not be able to understand the cross without God showing it to you. That's part of what happens, by the way, why his own disciples didn't get it when he tried to explain it to them before the cross. What happens after the cross? Now that they've seen it all play out, now they get it. Think about that. And that's one thing that the gospel subtly illustrates, is that the key to getting it finally is the resurrection, not the crucifixion. And then Jesus comes back, and then their eyes are open. And then the Spirit comes, and you know the rest of the story. And so none of the rulers of this age understood this. They had the crucified Lord of glory. But as it is written, what no eye hath seen, nor eye heard, nor heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him. These things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. You didn't figure this out by spending more time in the library or the lab. You're not going to figure it out that way. The only way you figure it out is Christ and the Spirit he sent revealed this ultimately. And that's why you know what you know. And so these things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. For the Spirit searches everything, even the depths of God. God's Spirit, of course, knows God's mind. For who knows a person's mind except the spirit of the person which is in him? Is that how it works for you? You know, no matter how long you've been married, your spouse may be able to say, don't cross your legs at me in that tone of voice. But the reality is, you know, and by the way, do we sometimes get frustrated? We sometimes feel like, oh, they should know. But there's always a limit. There's always a limit. Even with God, and that's part of the analogy from the lesser to the greater. If even with humans, you cannot really know what's going on with the other person unless they ultimately tell you, this is what I think, this is what I feel, whatever. Called communication skills. That's why we unfairly get mad with each other sometimes. Well, they should know. Come on. Paul's saying you should know better about that at a human level. How much more then, when we're dealing with God's stuff, you will not know what God is really up to by just looking at things. You have to have this God's own spirit to reveal to you what the mind of God is up to. So also, no one comprehends the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. Now, we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God. And there may well be here in verse 12 a little bit of a word play that Paul's up to here, because he's writing up kind of a parallel statement. Not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit of God. Now, here's the thing. When we hear the second half of that, the Spirit of God, and some of your translations may even do this, what do they do with the letter S in your translations, most of them? They capitalize it. Now, you got to understand something. There's capitalization in Greek. It's just all capitalized. The original manuscripts were written in all capital letters. So that's how you did Greek back then. The point is, they didn't capitalize, not capitalize. When we capitalize in English, what are the translators telling you they are interpreting this use of spirit as?
Proper name.
The third person of the Trinity, the capitalist, the deity, Spirit of God. But here's the catch. That line, there's maybe a little bit of a pun that Paul's after here, because the first spirit, the spirit of the world, is that an actual person? Or is that more like when we talk about the spirit of the age or the spirit of the times, or the, right? A mindset, something that's kind of, And again, it's a really apt analogy. Something that's all around us and in us, and we all get it, but you don't see it. You see its effects, you feel its effects, like when the wind blows. But you can't put your finger and say, there, right there, walking down the street. That's the spirit of the world right there. Right? You with me? So the contrast here is with a mindset of the world versus a mindset of God, but paradoxically, and Paul may be punning here, a mindset of God that can only be known by the capitalist spirit revealing. But you catch what Paul's up to there? Because the parallel is with a non-personal spirit. And so the mindset of God is known only by the spirit of God making it known. You're never going to figure this out on your own, which means you can't be impressed with worldly wisdom. You're not going to figure out by the world's values what God's values are. You have to basically make a complete break, and that's what the Spirit through the apostles is revealing. You with me? You catch Paul's argument. That makes sense. If you don't follow the capitalist spirit of God, you're going to wind up with the spirit of the world corrupting the spirit of God. You catch all the puns in there? Makes sense? That's what Paul is saying. So now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God. And we impart this in words not taught by human wisdom, but taught by the Spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual. Now, verse 13 is a problem. Calvinists love this verse because it makes it look like Paul is saying, if you're not careful, is Paul is saying, therefore, you need the Spirit to illuminate you. And unless the Holy Spirit illumines you, you will not be able to understand it. Thus, that's why we have total depravity and unconditional election and irresistible grace and the rest of the flower stuff. Look, that's not what Paul is saying. Paul is not saying that every individual needs some sort of spiritual illumination, or else they will never be able to know what God wants or understand Scripture or things like that. What he's saying, rightly understood in verse 15, especially if you think about what he's saying in verse 12, what he's saying is, well, in fact, it's even better, in fact, in verse 14. The natural person, the worldly person, does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him. He's not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. What he's ultimately saying in these verses is not you need a personal indwelling of the Spirit to grasp this. What he's saying is if you don't buy into the Spirit's mindset, you won't see the truths of what the Spirit is revealing. What is your operating system? You will never run an iOS app on Android. You will not run an Android app on iOS. And so if you don't take... And so what happens is if you don't realize you've got to do a complete operating system change, you're going to try to run Christian apps on a worldly operating system. The only way you can change your operating system, though, is to buy into the Spirit's mindset. Otherwise, you will wind up corrupting the apps. The apps will crash because you're still running on a worldly operating system. Does that make sense? Is that making sense? Mm-hmm. That's what he's saying. If you don't adopt the Spirit's mindset, so, fruits of the Spirit. You don't recognize certain values, certain hierarchies of priorities, certain goals. How do we determine what's wise? Well, what's God's goal in life? What's God's goal for me? What's God's goal for my children? What's God's goal for my money? What's God's goal for you? Why do I have these things? I'll never be able to make wise decisions that actually bring me closer to the kingdom or in line with the kingdom, as opposed to maybe not technically sinful, but certainly still worldly. So how am I going to figure out what I should wear and what's modest or not? God didn't draw lines. I don't want some legalist binding the lines on me and say this far or that high or this open or whatever. How are you going to make that decision? Well, the Spirit's values, including it does matter how it affects other people. Well, that's their problem. They need to be less worldly. They need to be less. They need to be less impressed with physique or my chiseled abs or whatever.
And then that's them thinking like the world.
That's the whole point. Wrong operating system is still at work. They're only making these values. Because again, what does Paul famously remind the Christians in Rome? It's not about your rights. If meat causes my brother to stumble, what will I never do again? But I have a right to eat meat. Because all things are lawful and all things are clean, man. But there's a value system. There's a different operating system in place. And so what Paul's trying to get those Christians to understand is the reason you've got the right, some technical knowledge correct. You never denies they're Christians, never denies that's a church there at Corinth. Technically, the doctrinal things are correct in those areas. But why are they still otherwise such a mess? Because the operating system has not been swapped out. Y2K happened spiritually. And everything crashed.
They haven't put on the mind of Christ.
That's it. And that's what he's saying. And the only way you will get that is by following the Spirit's revelation completely. You will never figure this out by the world's wisdom. the cross inverts all sense of reality, but it's ironically the ultimate revelation of reality. This is who God is, and this is who we're supposed to be. Yes, sir.
No, just, I would say reverts rather than inverts, because...
Yeah, fair enough.
I've just been thinking about, we talk about all this wisdom, and I'm reminded of Genesis 3, where it says that Eve saw that it was desirable to make one wise, right?
Yep.
And we've talked in the past about how that whole situation inverted reality, right? You had God at the top, and then all of a sudden God is at the bottom of that reality.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's kind of the reality that we live in now, right? But Christ reverts it back to how it should be.
Yeah.
Turns it back to the right order.
No, that's exactly right. And you know, when I teach Genesis, and some of you've seen this, I use this in Leviticus, because Leviticus is a commentary on Genesis, a reset of Genesis in some ways. You know, part of what God did in Genesis, and this is what Eric, something that Eric's commented, all falls apart. This is how reality was created to work by God. He brings order into things. He makes things and then places them where they're supposed to be, light and dark. You know, habitats, and he fills habitats, right? You know, days 1, 2, 3 have been filled, days 4, 5, and 6. He brings order to chaos. You know, the world was formless and void, and then God goes to work. Order creates hierarchy. When we hear the word hierarchy, we think about, you know, war. Things are more important, less important. You know, we attach value to it. It just simply means that there's always going to be, and there's always going to be a hierarchy. Communism, there's going to be absolute equality among the workers. From each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And as Orwell famously showed in Animal Farm, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. You will always have a hierarchy. The Politburo is eating better than the average Russian. Let's be real. There will always be a hierarchy. You cannot have perfect equality in the way we talk about it. Equality of human dignity and worth, yes. Equality in terms of everybody gets the same role, everybody gets the same outcome, that's not how it works. That's not how reality works. And we're going to destroy ourselves trying to bring a perfectly equal role and outcome in society. There will be a hierarchy. The question is, does the hierarchy that you're living in conform with the order as God established? Because the order is what gives a hierarchy. Hierarchy, putting things in their proper place, gives them a purpose, a role. What are, you know, when he puts the sun, moon, and stars out in day 4, he explicitly says, that's a perfect example of this, what are they there for? To control light and dark, and controlling light and dark to give days, seasons, years, to mark time. That's their role, that's their purpose. And their purpose then brings them a meaning. Why am I here? Why does this exist? What is this for? You begin to fudge with any of this, you lose touch with reality and it all falls apart. And by the way, will people do this in some way, shape, or form? Yes, because we have to have a hierarchy. There will be a hierarchy, no matter how much people claim. You know, and without hierarchy, or if people don't have a sense of hierarchy anymore at the street level, why am I here? What's my purpose? What should I be doing? And what's the meaning of life?
I mean, even as simple to, like, if you do, let's say, old school group projects, and everyone tries to be so nice to everybody, it ends up having a hierarchy because someone takes the lead and the other workers, it just naturally flows into
it. It's going to happen, man. It's going to happen. That's one of the fun things working with young people in camps and stuff during the summer is, you know, when you get your teams or your cabins, it's interesting over the first 24 hours to one, the kids naturally sort it out. And there will be leaders and there will be followers. There will be chiefs and there will be Indians. Anyways, let me say this real quick before the second bell catches. A little bit more, one last thing about the spirit, because again, you know, this passage is abused. And obviously the larger religious world, people want subjective experience. They believe in subjective experiences of the spirit. But again, think about how that's not what Paul is getting at here. Because part of what Paul is saying is the spirit brings unity. The irony, you know, the spirit of God's revelation is going to bring unity. It's part of this larger argument in this part of the book. But the reality is, subjective experiences of the spirit do not bring unity. They bring controversy. Because if I'm having my experience of the Spirit, and he's told me to do this, and you're having your experience of the Spirit, and he's told you to do that, if all these denominations all believe in the indwelling of the Spirit, why don't they all agree on things? All these denominations that believe in some sort of literal indwelling of the Spirit, okay, then why is there no more unity? Which is ironically Paul's whole argument about what the Spirit is doing with the Spirit's revelation. When you bow your knees to the Spirit's revelation, it's going to bring unity. That's part of his larger argument here in the first 4 chapters. Does that make sense? That's part of how you know that's not what Paul meant here. What he's saying is you have to buy into the Spirit's mindset, the value system of God as revealed by the Spirit. And unless you do that, you're not going to make sense of the cross. You're not going to make sense of how to live in unity and peace with each other. And so the irony is the work of the Spirit is an objective work, not a subjective work. But the indwelling of the Spirit is an inherently subjective experience. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Anybody want the last word real quick in the last 10 or 15 seconds?
I just think of, and this is going to sound really corny, but I always think of the animals that are described in the other theory, the evolutionary theory,
yeah,
as the simplest or the ones that are most designed to live in some of the harshest environments and
yeah,
can hack it anywhere. And so it's, that's part of that order. You know, yes, they're simpler, but there's a reason they're simpler,
yeah,
and they...
Yeah. Almost like God knew what he was doing. Yep.